Good morning. Welcome to the devotional session of Sunstone. This is the session where we always identify the true and faithful who come early in the morning to be enlightened, and it's a great opportunity. Please remember cell phones off. I think we've made that announcement enough times now. And we'll get right into our program. We're very privileged this morning to have as our speaker Francis Lee Menlove, who many of you know. Francis has spoken at these devotionals several times over the past few years, one of our most popular speakers. She is well known to many as one of the founders of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. In fact, that's how I first came to know of Francis Menlove, in the very first issue of Dialogue many, many years ago, and we won't say how many. She has a very insightful article that every student of Mormonism ought to read. She holds a PhD in psychology from the University of Michigan and a Master's of Divinity from Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California. She has 4 children, 6 grandchildren, and she is living in Oregon. And I will turn the time to Francis Lee Menlove.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming this early morning. I love to speak to the true and faithful. I'm going to talk about a parable. Matthew's parable of the final great division of the sheep and the goats is a discomforting story. It shakes us awake. The parable pushes us to ask this question: what if God isn't playing by our rules? You remember how it goes. You know the parable. Matthew places Jesus inside the story and describes this great separation. The Son of Man will separate people, one from another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. The sheep will go on the right, and the goats on the left. He will then say to those on his right, "Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me." To those on the left, he will say, "You that are accursed, depart from me unto eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me. Naked and you did not give me clothing. Sick and in prison and you did not visit me." The reaction of those on either side of him is identical. They are nonplussed and thunderstruck. Neither the sheep nor the goats have a clue what he's talking about. Both sides ask the same identical question: "Lord, when was it we saw you?" The sheep ask, "When was it we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?" And the sheep get that very famous answer: "Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me." And the goats ask, "When was it we saw you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you?" They get the equally well-known answer: "Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." "When was it we saw you, Lord?" The identical question from the sheep, who were totally unaware of the good they did, and from the goats, who were unaware they did anything wrong. In this story, the final performance appraisal reduces criteria to compassion. There is not a whisper about creeds or doctrine. There's not a word about cursing or attendance at church meetings or homosexuality. Nothing about fame, knowledge, or fortune. It's so simple, it's scary. Actually, that's not quite correct. It does not simply reduce to compassion. The difference between the sheep and the goats is action. It is compassion with action. The goats are goats because of inaction. They did nothing. There is no indication they had hostility or any ill will. They didn't do anything wicked. They just failed to do good. Those who take action, feed the hungry, give water to the thirsty, clothe the naked, take care of the sick, and visit the imprisoned are the sheep. They're in. People who don't are the goats. They're out. Like most parables, this one is subversive. It subverts the common understanding of the Last Judgment. In the final analysis, what counts is not about belonging to the right group or believing the right things. Even good intentions don't cut it. What counts is action, compassion with action. I imagine that all of us here at times have been sheep, and we've probably all been goats. We are seldom all good or all bad, but the point is stark. When we fail the needy, we fail Jesus. When we neglect the homeless, we neglect Jesus. When we persecute outcasts, we are persecuting Jesus. This story makes judgment present and continuous, and in essence, makes the needy our judge. I heard the Reverend James Forbes make this point a different way. Nobody, he asserts, gets into heaven without a letter of reference from the poor. The whole biblical tradition involves special care for victims. The poor, the widow, the stranger, the oppressed, the dispossessed. Kings are held accountable for how the poor fail. Prophets rail about the gap between the rich and the poor as a reason for God's judgment. But the Bible is concerned not only with suffering, but also the causes of suffering. In fact, it could be argued that the Bible is less concerned with alleviating the effects of injustice than eliminating its causes. William Sloane Coffin put it this way. Remember the prophet Amos said, "Let justice, not charity, roll down like mighty waters. Charity alleviates the effects of poverty. Justice seeks to eliminate the causes of it." And it's a lot easier to talk about charity than it is about social justice. Social justice talks leads to political controversy. But ignoring social justice issues because they raise political issues is itself a very political position in favor of the status quo. We are called on to be more than an effective and compassionate ambulance service. It is important to save poor orphans from burning buildings, but it is also vital to work toward a society where orphans are not poor and buildings adhere to fire codes. In other words, as followers of Jesus, we are called not only to care for those who are suffering, but also to transform the conditions that bring about suffering. Social justice is different from charity. Charity is often the band-aid that covers injustice. What makes a just society? The philosopher John Rawls proposes a thought experiment for teasing out the answer. That's a rather Mormon kind of thought experiment. Pretend, all of you pretend with me for a moment that we're in heaven. We're waiting to get our earthly bodies. We are all sitting around that great conference table in the sky with several other spirits in waiting. Our group is given the assignment of designing the basic social contract for the society in which we will live. We are not permitted to know our class, our race, our gender, our religion, our genetic makeup, our gifts, or our handicaps. We are behind what Rawls calls a veil of ignorance. We don't know if we will be a sharecropper or a musician, a board chair, a janitor, sighted or blind, or the parent of a severely handicapped child. In other words, it's the luck of the draw. Where does this little thought experiment take us? I've tried it with church groups and philosophy classes. Put people in small groups and ask them to spend a couple of hours hashing out the kind of society they want to be dropped into, and the results are pretty consistent. First, our spirits in waiting have to take luck seriously, very seriously. Luck is all those gifts and all those curses for which we can take neither credit nor blame. If we take luck seriously, the boundaries of empathy are enlarged, and good schools for poor children, clean drinking water, living wages, affordable, accessible health care take on a new urgency. When we are forced to ignore all knowledge that might lead us to self-interest rather than our sense of social justice, when we don't know who we will be, we sign up only for arrangements that protect us no matter the luck of the draw. In other words, a vision for the general good, a vision for justice as fairness, a remembrance that we live in community. So what do these people of goodwill actually decide behind this veil of ignorance? They generally opt for traditional religious liberties and political liberties with protections for equality for all citizens. Economically, they permit inequalities, but only when they bring up the least well off. Capitalism with a human face was the way one student expressed it. One salty old journalist told the group at the end of a half-day session on this that for him the exercise was very disconcerting, even destabilizing. He said he was going to have to rethink his opposition to universal health care. Strong safety nets is another frequently heard phrase in these thought experiment discussions. My favorite comment came from a young college student who said, "Social policy must at least ensure that we are equal to become unequal." That we are equal to become unequal. Rawls contends that this, the moral point of view, justice is fairness, is the position that reasonable people are forced to take when deliberately placed behind a veil of ignorance. Rawls comes up with two principles of social justice. First, each person should have the right to the most extensive basic liberty compatible with a like liberty for others. And second, social and economic inequalities should be arranged so that they advantage the worst off. The thought experiment is a little like the instruction we heard as a child and then used as parents when there were two kids and only one brownie left in the pan. Okay. Okay, you kids, quit arguing. One of you gets to cut, the other gets to choose. That settles it. You remember that. One divides, the other chooses. The clever little rule of division harnesses greed and makes for fairness. If people don't know if they will be a winner or loser, smart or dumb, Christian, Jew, Muslim or atheist, straight or gray, they sign up to arrangements that protect them whatever. They design public institutions to ameliorate some of the burdens of bad luck. They take luck seriously. Luck, all those gifts and all those curses for which we can take neither credit nor blame. The lottery of life. Taking luck seriously is hard. Do you all know the most frequently quoted Bible verse that is not in the Bible? It's this: God helps those who help themselves. 3/4 of Americans believe it's in the Bible. It is not. Actually, Benjamin Franklin said that, and it is counter-biblical. It certainly doesn't sound like Jesus as he separates the sheep and the goats. God helps those who help themselves also doesn't sound much like love your neighbor as yourself, or love your enemies, or bless them that curse you, or when you do it unto the least of them, you do it unto me. It's hard for us to be reminded that so much we have is due to luck, the good luck of family, health, talents, timing. It can be unsettling to abandon that rather American myth that the rich are divinely entitled to the wealth and poor people are to blame for their want. The notion that poverty is simply a reward for laziness cannot survive what we now know about the dynamics that shape human societies. We know about the effects of racism, sexism, discrimination, war, We know unfairness happens, and it happens more regularly and more routinely if the social systems aren't alert to their effects. Systems matter. It is no longer possible to maintain the simplistic notion that people get what they deserve. We have to take luck seriously. The world is not fair. The rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous, and natural disasters harm everyone in their path. Remember Job's friends marveled at how wicked he must be to deserve so much punishment? Those comforters tried to explain Job's apparently undeserved suffering by arguing that he really did deserve it, that it was God's punishment. This pious orthodoxy of his friends was resisted by Job and shot out of the water by God's rebuke from the whirlwind. We are called to see Jesus in other people, even the sick who we disdain because we believe it is a result of their lifestyle, even the prisoner who we find reprehensible, even the stranger who we fear, and even the hungry who, after all, should be able to take care of themselves. If we hope to attend the impact of systems on people's lives, we must examine our political positions, not just from our own point of view, but from the viewpoint of the least among us. We need to look beyond self-interest and work toward the common interest. We need to ask why people are hungry, or thirsty, or naked, or in need of medical care, or in prison. We are called to look at the structures that keep people from earning the food they need, the policies that keep people from having clean drinking water, the injustices in our criminal justice system. For any policy, we must ask, does this policy seek the common good? Does it reflect care for the poor and protect the vulnerable? Who benefits? Who suffers? Who wins? Who loses? Indifference to the public sphere is anti-biblical. Anti-biblical. Charity and almsgiving are indispensable in our world. But systemic problems can't be solved by charity and almsgiving. The scandals of workplace safety come to mind. Collective action is needed to find solutions to problems that are beyond our power of any of us to deal with, as individuals or as churches. Strong levies, clean air and water, truth-telling on financial reports, building codes that keep buildings standing during earthquakes, excellent schools. Collective action is needed to solve what Martin Luther King Jr. described as the most shocking and inhumane injustice in healthcare. And since watching the movie An Inconvenient Truth this week, I've been wondering if we were now not only called to hear the groaning of the poor, but also the groaning of our planet. The story of the sheep and the goats subverts our usual understanding of the Last Judgment and our understanding of what really counts. Why? The point, I believe, is to help us squelch our inner goat and nourish our inner sheep. To live like Jesus taught us, even in his absence. And the point is to understand that Jesus is always standing around us. Always standing around us in the disguise of those who suffer. This is a daunting task, and I believe taking luck seriously helps. We have to resist that narrow vision that makes us eager to do charity only. We are called to deal with what causes people to need charity. If we took luck seriously, we would be on our way toward fixing some of our fixable injustices. And remember Micah's injunction. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? If we took luck seriously, we might have an easier time with that do justice part of the admonition. A healthy awe for luck might help us move toward being a little more like sheep and a little less like goats. Now, in what may well be the first for any Sunstone Symposium, Carol, the very first, I'm going to quote Bono, U2's lead singer. Listen to what Bono said as he addressed the National Prayer Breakfast. This is Bono. Look, whatever thoughts you have about God, most will agree that, well, if there is a God, he has a special place for the poor. In fact, the poor are where God lives. Check Judaism, check Islam, check it pretty much anyone. I mean, God may well be with us in our mansions on the hill, I hope so. He may well be with us in all manner of controversial stuff. Maybe, maybe not. But the one thing we can all agree, all faiths, all ideologies, is that God is with the vulnerable and the poor. God is in the slums, in the cardboard boxes where the poor play house. God is in the silence of a mother who has infected her child with a virus that will end both their lives. God is in the cries heard under the rubble of war. God is in the debris of wasted opportunity in lives. And God is with us if we are with them. And God is with us if we are with them. Finally, I'm going to end with an old, venerable old Latin American prayer. It's a short prayer, and I'm going to recite it twice. Lord, to those who hunger, give bread. And to those who have bread, give the hunger for justice. Lord, to those who have hunger, give bread. And to those who have bread, give the hunger for justice. Amen. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Francis, for that insightful and inspiring message. As typically, we do not have questions in our devotional sessions, but I'm sure Francis would be happy to speak individually with anyone. Francis has prepared a little handout, wouldn't be the right word. It's kind of a bookmark. It's the quotation of one of the scriptures that she used, and it will be available at the back door as you go out. The next sessions will begin at 8:45. So thank you for being here.